everyone. Welcome back to The Gods Will Not Save You. This is Jakob.
Hey, everybody. How's it going? I'm Willie, and this is the podcast. Well, it's one of the podcasts where the co-hosts do a deep read of each and every episode of the hit HBO show, The Wire.
And we are here back to talk about season 4, episode 5, Alliances. And if you want to become like a paid ally, donate at anchor.fm/thegodswillnotsaveyou/support.
Right. Thank you for that. Also, give us 5 stars on iTunes, or, you know, click the little heart icon on Spotify to let us know that we have some fans out there. You know, we check the Anchor analytics sometimes, and, you know, we got some people out there listening to us, we think.
Yeah.
We haven't lost faith or given up hope yet. We're hoping maybe for the sleeper effect that happens with all the David Simon shows, maybe in like a few years, you know.
Oh, yeah.
People will realize that maybe we kind of sort of knew what we were talking about. So thanks, everybody who's stuck with us so far.
Yeah, we appreciate you. And like you said, man, we're going to be fine. Yeah. I bet you in maybe 3 to 4 years tops, we'll be able to pretty much retire based on all the support that pours out for us.
Right. It's great to have these alliances for sure.
Yeah. Out the gates here, the boys are hanging out at right. their, you know, little like clubhouse, their urban clubhouse.
Right.
And, you know, Willie, it's summer, and this season jumped off as, you know, Boys of Summer. This is kind of like their version of what normal or kids who would grow up in a more, you know, mainstream environment, you know, right. would be going to summer camp and all that. And this is kind of their version of like, ooh, ghost stories around a campfire, right?
Right. Exactly.
Except it's, you know, there's gunshots going off and
there's gunshots going off and, they're doing some like retroactive, like, you know, what do you call it? Like rationalization for like, maybe thinking like, oh, you know, Lex is dead, but he's special dead. Like he's just still a zombie. So maybe, Randy, you don't have to feel as bad if Lex is still walking around and Chris just, you know, did a special hex on him or something. But, even though this is like kind of a extreme situation that these middle schoolers are in, like having to deal with like the PTSD and like the guilt of, you know, aiding in someone's death, there is still like some relatability here of, you know, kids kind of spooking each other out with like tales of supernatural. And you know, like David Simon said, like, it's kind of like all of our childhoods until it isn't.
Exactly.
Because like, I don't know if you remember, like in our youth, like high school, maybe like even like early college days when we would go like walking on the secret sidewalk in Fremont and like we would reach a point where there was like a tunnel or something and somebody would be like, oh shit, like, I swear to God, like I saw eyes popping out at the end of the tunnel. Let's not go. Let's like get out of here. So speaks to a lot of universal truths about how like kids or, you know, in our situation, young adults.
Yeah, exactly. You're like in our youth, like that just shows like, you know, these kids pretty much almost adults, you know, 12, 13. Remember when we were young, Jakob, when we were like 18, 19 year olds?
Yeah.
I think I went there once. It is pretty creepy regardless of age, though.
Right.
Stay off the secret sidewalk.
Yeah. But yeah, just like these kind of conversations, you know, art is like very great at like kind of like putting yourself in various situations, no matter how like disparate from your own, and like, you know, finding ways that it can relate to you. But definitely like when the gunshots started going off, well, I don't know. Like I was like, Naaman doesn't know shit. Like, you know, here at The Gods Will Not Save You.
Oh, you knew the caliber.
Yeah. We're gun guys. We're car guys. We know all this shit. So, and like Michael, you know, did his little, you know, explanation thing,
40 cal.
Yeah, I'm like, of course, yeah. Come on, we knew that answer before he even rattled it off, and you know, we instantly recognize Naaman for kind of like the fraud that he is.
Exactly, and that's definitely not a nine. Like we all know that, right? Especially, well, I don't know. I mean, D-Mob was pretty active back in the day. But I don't know about your side, yeah, man. Naaman always bluffing, but this is kind of like the, you know, their version, you know, of like urban Goonies, but emphasis on the goons.
Oh, nice.
Especially, you know, as Chris is walking up after, right. Well, that's later on, but, it is a creepy hangout.
Yeah. I also, you know, I consult Alan Sepinwall's writings after every episode, and he made like a lot of lengthy comparisons to Stand By Me, but kind of like an inverted version of that, where like, you know, these kids are like going, they're on a mission to like go find a dead body, but it's kind of like, you know, the beginning of them like going into or like maturing into adulthood, but you know, with like this really crazy, you know, excellently filmed scene at the end of this episode that we'll get into later on. It kind of like represents like, you know, the reinforcement of the trauma that they have to go through day in and day out, and how the guilt is always going to kind of stay with Randy and lead him down like a horrible path of being bounced around in the foster system. Yeah, I'm not laughing at the like material. It's
yeah,
just,
what
like,
is that, man?
I know. Like it's just
that guy got shot in the face. Much needed violence.
It's just something I do to kind of like. It's because I'm uncomfortable sometimes talking about this, and it's the only way I know how to like kind of like alleviate the tension. So I apologize to anybody out there who thinks I'm being callous.
I mean, Willie is. Probably. No one other than people who already know us, you know what we look like, but Willie does have one of the best like straight face, like psycho kind of faces. And I also may be intermittently like just glaring at him at inopportune moments.
Yeah,
it's like an inside joke, but
kind of glaring at me the way Michael does when he refuses Marlo's handout for free money, which you know, segueing into the latter part of this scene, Michael and Snoop, or no, sorry, Chris and Snoop.
Coop.
Just happened to know the exact geographical coordinates of where these middle schoolers are hanging out. And they make Michael a pretty direct offer to join their crew. You know, we get some insight into how like maybe naive or innocent Michael is still about like all these things going on, and kind of like drawing a direct parallel, like I said, with the scene earlier in the season when Marlo's people try to offer up Michael some money and he refuses it. But this time, you know, even though he may seem conflicted about it, I'm pretty positive he puts that fat wad of cash that Chris places in his palm into his pocket. And it's kind of like the difference between these two situations, that this is more of an advance than a handout. Kind of like more or less like trapping him into this like employment situation.
That's entrapment. Yeah, what would Bodhi have to say about
contrapment?
This? Yeah, that's contrapment. There you go.
But you know, it's not like it's hard to say like in that situation that like I wouldn't you know take the money from like these cold-blooded killers. You know, it's really tough moral ethical situation that you're in.
Yeah, I mean, what else can you say,
right?
Michael's he's trapped now.
Yeah,
it's tough. So what else?
What do we think of Dookie knowing pretty much like the whole scoop Chris and Snoop have been doing this whole time, and like how he know, like he has like all the information that's like stumping some of like Baltimore's finest in the homicide department? Like, I know he said a little bit in the previous episodes about working for Marlo's Pigeon Coop, but do we buy him like having this much like insight and knowledge onto like how Chris and Snoop are like operating their business and like
I'd buy it.
You buy it?
He's a geo he's a geo genius for sure.
I mean, we know he's very smart, but
yeah. I mean if he does, if he is the next Bubbles in a way, right? You know, Bubbles is like the, was a great example you gave. He's like the court jester,
Greek chorus or something. Or
yeah, he's like, kind of just in the background observing constantly, and he picks up on all these little details. But yeah, what does he live? I don't know where Dookie lives just yet. I mean, even if the film location's not, you know, near Calhoun, which is where in West Baltimore he says that the vacant is, but you know, what was he doing out in that area? Because later on when they go up to that house or the row house, and it's kind of in the weeds. I mean, they're not just, Chris and Snoop are pretty, I mean, they're discreet about it. So what would Dookie be doing in that area at that hour of, like, they're doing it in the middle of the night pretty much. So,
right. Yeah.
And this is that guy that they go see at the end, sorry, like jumping ahead.
No, it's all good.
Is he the first killing we saw? Is he the first killing of the season, basically, where it's to do with the locks? And then he's like,
yeah, I don't.
He's like, I got you, don't worry. And then the guy vomits pretty much what's on the intro, because the dead body, like, you can kind of see the hair look similar.
Right. I mean, to be honest with you, I watched this episode twice.
Me too, man. This is why everyone is going, this will be the most precise analysis yet.
And like,
I'm finally both, on Willie's level.
Both times I felt like the scene was like intentionally like lit really dark, and I couldn't make out. Maybe I need to like adjust my settings on my TV or something, because I had a really hard time like making out like the specifics of the corpse. So I just like took it as like a general like, oh, this is like horrifying, really. Yeah. Stressful, horrible situation that these kids are in, and you only need to see a little bit of it, and your imagination will let you run wild.
Yeah, it's a decomposed body, but okay, I don't want to get like too forensics here. Mm. But my main other point is: was Dookie holding his bag of clothes while they're walking up to the vacant?
I don't know, because earlier in the episode, like Prez was like confounded as to why like he didn't have his new clothes on him, or like why he was still stinking, and like Crystal gave him the 411 about like how his family is just like reselling his clothes on the corner. But maybe all along, like, Dookie was just like really paranoid about like getting his clothes jacked by his family, so he just keeps them in his bag, and was like afraid that they were gonna like sell them while he was away out of his house, so he brought them with him to the row house.
Or is that the bag that of fresh clothes Prez gave him in the class like that day, because it's at the end of that day, right? Maybe.
Yeah, we'll never know.
Oh yeah, we gotta get back to that. That's like a classic.
Fuck the average viewer.
Damn, dude, remember, that's not specifically you out there listening.
Yeah.
Willie does love and appreciate you.
I mean, if you've listened to every episode of our podcast up until this point, we definitely don't consider you average, because we've been dropping these fucking little nuggets on you all along. So now you're a wired genius.
Oh yeah,
you got that fire wire.
What?
Yeah. And then what do we make of this little scene where Naaman is visiting Weebay? And like, it's kind of like, it's like this weird like dichotomy that his mom is setting up for him. Cause on one hand, she's like, you need to be out on the corner selling drugs, but also, you know, be good in school and respect the authority figures. So it's like, they're giving him all kinds of like mixed messages here.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, Naaman's all screwed up. Delonda's
bad parenting all around, kind of.
Brianna or Delonda?
Oh, fuck. I don't know. I don't know.
That's her name, right?
Delonda. Yeah, I mean, Delonda is like automatically, like, you know, you recoil at like the sight of her parenting and like how awful it is. But Brianna, like, you need to like get invested in like talking with her to find out like how manipulative and awful she is. But Delanda just like wears her heart on her sleeve. Didn't like, so from, you know, from all the pieces matter, like they interviewed the actress who played her and she was saying like she worked with youth and like one of the girls she was like mentoring or, you know, talking to had a nose ring in that just said bitch. And she's like, ah, can you please take that out? And she's like, oh no, my mom wants me to wear it because she wants me to be reminded of what I am. So it's like, she probably, like all that just probably like informed her performance and it made it that much more effective. Cause I gotta say, that actress does a terrific job.
Yeah, Cleveland, that's where she worked. So everyone loves her though, Offset, right? She's regarded as one of the nicest people.
Sandy McCree. Who plays Delanda Bryce.
Yeah. Oh, Sandy.
Actress, youth advocate, and educator, Sandy McCree, known for edgy street tough performance as Delanda Bryce on HBO's The Wire, has been on the front line of arts education and media literacy for over 21 years. That's a IMDb typo. They said years twice, but awesome. That's great.
Great work.
Yeah. But then, so we get into like this whole conversation where Weebay is like common theme that's like reiterated throughout the show, where he's talking about how the new way of doing things is different from the old way of doing things. And it's kind of like, how does he know? He's been like behind bars for like the last three seasons. How would he be like privy to like the information of how Marlo Stanfield is doing things? Has like Avon just been like telling him how fucked up shit is there, like how fucked up shit is like in the outside world now, and he's just like kind of bringing those talking points back to his son. But it also is kind of like he's talking about like, oh, if Marlo pulled this shit back in the day, he'd be in a trunk on his way to Leakin Park. And it's like a location that we see like later on in the episode with Bunk and Freeman trying to look for dead bodies out there, and you know, they're shocked by how that's not used as a dumping ground anymore. So it's like multiple characters from different walks of life are lamenting the old way of doing things.
It's like the old school versus the new school, right? And I mean, how is, yeah, he seems a little perturbed. I mean, he still loves Naaman, so he's like, man, be careful. Like, if Bodhi's not tough enough, I've known Bodhi, and look at you. It's this, you know, it's just a lot of, you know, he's having an identity crisis on top of being in eighth grade. So,
yeah, Bodhi's a soldier. Let's talk about the what's going on at the middle school. Randy is getting paid to keep watch outside of a bathroom door while two guys perform a devil's three-way on a girl.
A what?
A devil's... That's what it's called, right? When two guys... never mind. Sorry.
You would get it. It's like middle school. And I don't want to attach a...
But that's like, when, like, I'm just taking it like from the, when they were questioning Brett Kavanaugh about the Supreme Court.
Oh my.
Hearings. Like, what, yes. Like, cause they like referred to his like calendar as journal. He's like, why do you keep mentioning Devil's Three Way? And he's like, oh, it's a drinking game. And then like fact checkers were like, oh no, if you check the Urban Dictionary, it means blah, blah. Anyway.
Well, just for the record, that's Willie's interpretation. I don't know what happened in there.
He said like, we're gonna get it on with Tiffany, right?
And I've known like high schoolers that said they've had sex with like 80 girls, so, and it's obviously not true, but I mean, something happened.
Yeah,
I'm gonna let you, you know,
something nefarious.
Brett Kavanaugh's defense, it's like what happened in the, no, it's not like what happened in The Wire
season 4 episode 5, Alliances. I love beer.
Yeah. Everyone, Willie is in like epic form today.
When am I not? So being, you know, involved in education yourself in the past.
In the past.
What do you think of Prez's performance here when he's like coming up with these new rules? Do you think he was right to erase Naaman's name off the chalkboard and letting him off the hook of detention?
I don't know, man. I mean, he's not really effective as a like classroom manager, even though he's coming to terms with it. I mean, it's just, you know, I guess your credibility is pretty much all you have in that situation. Right. So you can't, you know, be a hard ass and then just like, you know, go back on your word, because then that's what I was writing like as a joke, obviously a joke. Is letting everyone out of detention early when they insist the worst mistake of his career. Because I mean, now he has no legitimacy. Oh wait, Prez has done far worse things. Obviously it's a joke, everyone.
Yeah, exactly.
But you know, Naaman's obviously, yeah, he's going to be marked as a, you know, corner kid, and
they do show up when you need them.
Exactly. That's what, you know, Bunny's saying and all that. So, you know, an hour detention for not doing your work, I don't know. That's pretty ridiculous in my opinion. Like, yeah. You know, but if you say you're going to do something, I guess if you threaten, like I obviously part-timer substitute, you know, I never like gave detention. Even if I did long-term, it's like, oh, if you say you're going to call someone's parents or like, have someone else do it, you got to follow through, because then they know that you're just BSing, like you're bluffing. So, but yeah, you know, it's just about consistency, and that's what Naaman is protesting. That one day it's one thing, the next day it's this. So, you know, I think the work that Prez was doing, you know, building rapports and learning about the background of the students and where they're coming from is what he needed to do from the. He's just overwhelmed because he has no experience and he's Prez to begin with. So that's the work you should probably start with to learn. Like, you know, you gotta, these are people. So,
right.
But yeah, I mean, Naaman's obviously lashing out. Well, this is all happening. I know here at the Gods Will Not Save You, we're bringing you a linear podcast episode just as The Wire's, but this outburst and him, you know, going at it with Prez, who, by the way, is like going full cop, like, show me your work, or, you know, it's like, show me your ID. It's like straight up cop stuff, which Naaman obviously picks up on. But this is all happening prior to the visit with Weebay or after?
I mean, it must be, because like Weebay, like he's telling
dad, like, it's prior.
Like, I'm suspended for 3 days. Yeah.
Stupid Yaku. But, you know.
Don't say it about yourself. No self-deprecation on this podcast from now on.
I'm so stupid. So in my opinion, it's pretty dumb to begin with to say hour detention. Is that even legal? I mean, like they said, you know, we got places to go and Michael's got to look out for his brother. You know, these kids are in really difficult situations. So how does Prez not understand, like, you know, that an hour after school could mean life or death, or it could mean a lot.
But then when, like, you know, in the scene, like, after the class, when the boys are talking with Donut, and he's like, oh, yeah, like, Mrs. D is keeping him in there forever. She's, like, hardcore. Like, doesn't it seem like Prez, like, kind of has, like, a moment of, like, realization that he got played by his students? Like, oh, like, she's allowed, like, she's, like, being a hard ass and, like, keeping them in detention, like, I just gotta, like, not let these little kids, like,
run over me
so
they can miss their bus and then have to transfer an extra 3 times, or, you know, now it's almost dark when they're walking home. That's safe.
Michael's just gonna have to let his little brother Bugs suffer at the hands of his abusive parents.
Yeah, he's probably just playing PlayStation.
Again, not laughing at the situation.
No, nah, man, it's hella funny, man.
I'm laughing at Jakob's, you know, dramatic reenactment.
Yeah, man, thank you. And thanks for calling on me for expertise about the classroom, because you know me, man.
No, I'm just saying, like,
I think,
you know,
teachers hated me because I never reported kids. I never, like, oh, yeah, if these kids act up, like, leave me a list. I was like, kids, like, I got to do my job, but I am kind of on your side. Like, I understand. Like, I'm a sub. Yeah. We all had subs. Like, I'm not trying to snitch you out. Right. Even though I'm like, wait, I'm an adult in this room. Why am I thinking like this? But I don't want these, you know, it's like, you know, it's a different scenario. Damn, does Prez ever have a sub? No, he doesn't.
No, man, he...
Damn, the best ability is availability, though, right? Teacher of the year.
There you go. I mean, he does... I mean, he's giving, like, he's, like, preventing Dookie from starving, so...
Yeah, that's pretty messed up. He doesn't even wait to go back to the desk to eat. He just, like, just starts munching on the sandwich. Man.
Great acting from Jermaine Crawford.
Pretty brutal stuff. And he is learning more about why Michael can't stay after school. Michael's just so, like, such a good student, even though he's not engaged because they're mass murder, psychopath, serial killers recruiting him. he's basically like a child soldier, like, getting recruited.
Basically, yeah. I mean, Prez recognizes that he's, like, smart enough and, like, can understand the work, but he's getting the silent treatment from him in these instances. It's, like, one of the very many first warning signs we have about Michael going down a dangerous path.
Much unneeded violence for Michael. Yeah, he's like, you're not doing your work, Michael. You know what that means? Detention. It's like, what? Does that work? We got to get some educators we know on the line. Like, do you give your kids an hour detention for not, like, for being distraught and, like, traumatized and then not doing homework?
Well,
or classwork?
You know what former educator I would like to get on the line is Ed Burns and ask him about the scene where Bunny is, like, putting forth the whole idea of the stoop kid versus the corner kid, and, like, he gets some pushback from Parenti.
Yeah, it's like something Italian.
Yeah, and Grace about, like, how, like, his terminology is problematic. I mean, that's from, like, all our readings, that's and what Ed Burns has said about the education system, that's kind of, like, how the conversation went down, right? Is that, like, he was like, these are my observations about, like, what's going on in the community, and they're like, whoa, 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 that's tracking. I mean,
it seemed to work, like, it, whether work is the right term in its finality, but they were enacting this plan up at Hamilton where he worked, right? So it did go over for a certain amount of time. I forgot the exact, you know, timeline. Sorry for not bringing that, but I think we were talking about in the first episode, you're always at an advantage because you're, like, listening to what we had just talked about on the first cut. And I'm like, the only thing I can recall is the last thing that I edited, which was the first episode. But, you know, yeah, he got it going, but then they shut it down, so.
Right.
Damn North Avenue. Ooh, loving the Geo drops. Yaki loves Geo.
But kind of, you know, similar how this whole experiment turns out in the show, because, you know, the academic guy is like, oh, but, you know, they're going to write about this in papers and, you know, it's going to be, you know, great intellectual fodder. And, like, Bunny's like, okay, but so, like, these kids are still going to be dealing with all these crises and it's just going to be people in academic circles reading about what we did. And, you know.
So what do you think about it? And what do you think about, you know, Claudel Withers' principal just being like, whatever, if it helps, you know, my teachers, you know, I mean, what are your thoughts on the whole tracking debate?
I mean, it's a, I don't know, man. I'm not an academic type, but it could be maybe, like, quote unquote problematic the way they're, you know, designating these different groups of kids, but their, you know, heart is in the right place and their intentions are noble of, like, trying to, you know, acclimate people who have been, like, forced into really shitty situations, kind of, like, into normal society and getting them to experience things that, you know, so many other people just take for granted. So, I don't know. I think it's a good thing that Withers, or Claudel Withers, the principal, said to him at one point, he said, thank you, because it is the only time someone in the system will think to say it.
Ooh. So you are on board then with Renegade Claudell Withers and his assessment of the dysfunctional Baltimore City Public Schools.
Nothing else they're doing at the school seems to be working for these kids anyway. Like, at least they're coming in and trying to shake things up.
And they're dedicating an actual curriculum to address kids.
And as we see down the line, like, you know, this kind of like unorthodox teaching style does actually end up working for Naaman. It's like one of the few, you know, unlike Mark Maron saying like, oh, the one person who has a hopeful storyline is Bubbles. Is like, okay, but like, did you not pay attention to Naaman's whole story?
No. Yeah. What about Poot? I mean, he might have the burn, but he's, you know, he got out too.
His dick might be looking like a chicken wing, but he's employee of the month at Foot Locker.
Yeah. I wanted to know though, at Tillman, was there already like a special ed class or special day class, they're called elsewhere, for severely, like, I guess that's more like, you know, kids with special needs and stuff, but obviously these kids have like severe issues and trauma that they're dealing with. What I'm saying is, doesn't necessarily mean you have to be, you know, in like a wheelchair, you know, have a severe learning disability or cerebral palsy to be in a class, like a special day class. I mean, there's students who like, they look physically, you know, like, you know, not normal. God damn it. It's like,
no, I get what
this
you're
is
saying.
Being recorded. What I'm trying to say is, you know, these kids would, like Bunny says, you know, they're getting suspended every other day. Or I know, like, when we were in middle school and high school, and I know we went to like a special elementary school, which was full of crazy ass kids, yeah, really. Which people don't seem to understand. Had like some kids with severe. Anyway, that's a whole different story. You know, we had in school detention, or I remember there was TAPS. I don't know if you ever heard of TAPS, which was basically like an offsite, almost like in school suspension, but sounded more like a juvenile hall type thing where they just put you in a room and force you to sit like at a desk and do your work.
Right.
So, I mean, that's his point. It's like, you know, if that program exists for these kids, you know, then why can't we just put them in a class together and actually work on some of the problems that they're, you know, they're facing, and then that would help alleviate the stress from the teachers who might not have the training or resources to address them.
I mean, certainly Sherrod would be part of that program if he kept on coming to school, but he has like already been so forgotten by the system at this point that like,
he's
not even like bumping, like he's not even registering on their radar, so to speak.
Nice kid. Just, yeah, he's definitely like actually on the corner for sure. Even if, I don't know though, his behavior in the class, like he just wants to leave. He's not like,
he's not like causing disruption or anything. He's just like illiterate and can't sit still but doesn't heed lessons well.
I think though that like Claudell Withers, you know, he's going out on a limb. So kids, what I'm trying to say is that even if, you know, it's supposed to be a secret, other schools would probably have liked this if this were, you know, I know we're like, I'm getting into the weird simulation I do because I lack the ability and skills to, you know, analyze this from like a more critical distance or whatever.
But
I mean, there was a huge thing in real life Baltimore where kids that were being suspended or, you know, problematic in these schools were pretty much just shipped around from school to school.
Yeah.
So it's just like shuffling the deck, but all the kids are just going from here to there. So like if other schools are like, wait, oh man, Tillman's like not sending us those like problematic kids who, you know, have behavioral issues, you know, that's like, we can rock with that because they're actually, the problem's not just being swept under the rug or passed down the line to the next nearest middle school. So, you know, but, yeah, man. Old Principal Withers. I left a little note in there just randomly. I didn't even intend, Willie, to look up these details in case you're like, God damn it, there goes Jakob, like putting some random. I was trying to research a different story or something That was about Linkin Park. But anyways, this just popped up. It was like in 2015, pretty much right before the school year started, 30 out of the 180 schools didn't even have a principal yet.
Jesus.
No, 30 out of the 180 schools lost principals that year. So the turnover rate for principals in Baltimore City schools was twice the national average, which was kind of alarming because I was like, wait, that's only twice. So other schools, like nationwide, the average is, you know, just basically what I'm trying to say is I thought that amount of turnover would be like six times higher than national average. I'm like, wait, there's so much turnover
already. Yeah, already. Public school.
So, but yeah, that's still disturbing. But yeah. Leadership, you know, so he's like, hey, I'm probably going to like lose my job anyway. So whatever, this helps. It's kind of disturbing, right?
It is a little bit. But
anyways,
you know, it's probably, as you stated, it's not a problem that's just, you know, localized to Baltimore. It's a national problem and
definitely
underfunded, school districts all throughout the country or, you know, places where, you know, they're, mental deterioration factories for a lot of these, people who are taking on educator roles in there.
Yeah, man.
We talked a lot about Tillman. Do we want to mention anything about how Donut uses his skills to get Prez's car open so he can get his car keys?
The Southeast District is going to come looking for Donut once Prez snitches on him to Valchek.
I mean, Valchek is already at the center of like all these other like crazy happenings in this episode.
But I mean, come on, is this realistic? Prez is going to just abandon his cop sense and just be like, oh yeah, it's normal for Donut to have a Slim Jim or whatever it's called stuffed in his like shoe.
I mean, maybe he's kind of happy to like let that, maybe he's just like so anti, you know, police doing things by the book as a cop by this point. He's just like, whatever, man, like that's not my job anymore. I don't even have to be concerned about this.
I think at that hour, he would have been so exhausted that he just wants to get as far away from Tillman as possible.
Yeah, go home and watch a football game where nobody even wins. Just one side loses slowly more than the other. And his wife wants to ease his stress by going on a walk. Like, ugh, I'm trying to save this kid Dookie's life by giving him a sandwich. He's not even wearing the clothes I'm giving him. But yeah, Valchek is doing his like weird backdoor dealings of getting on people's sides where it's more, you know, opportunistic for him. He's forming alliances with people who he thinks might be in power so, you know, he could get leverage from himself. So he goes to Carchetti and his campaign team and gives them the 411 of how Burrell and like the police, like the homicide department, were pulling some shady shit to avoid, you know, election time controversies with pulling Jakob's best friend Ed Norris off of the Braddock case.
Oh, friend of the show.
Yeah, putting Kima on. And it's pretty interesting that like you know, Carchetti and Norm D'Agostino, you know, Valchek is like, oh yeah, and they hired a broad, no less, right in front of a woman. They're all pretty like openly, you know, disdainful of him. Like pretty make it pretty clear to the audience that they don't like this guy and that he seems, they see him as kind of like eccentric and, you know, manipulative and stuff. But it's like, hey man, like he gave us some intel. Sooner or later, we're probably going to have to like do a favor for him at some point. And it's this episode is really great at showing like how opportunistic people can become with seemingly going over to the other side and like giving information that will benefit their quote unquote enemies with like the understanding that they're going to get some riches in the end or get some kind of reward for their, you know, backdoor dealings, manipulative behavior.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, okay, yeah, so they don't like Valchek. They're like, yeah, he's a real piece of work, Norm said. And then Carcetti's breaking down like, oh, yeah, well, you know, if you want to get the first district, which is, you know, that part of town, like eastern and southeast Baltimore, like the white areas of Frank Sabatka's, you know, rest in peace, his ex-stomping ground and all that kind of, well, maybe not exactly Locust Point, but those kind of people, like the ethnic white folk, you know, you gotta like saddle up or whatever he says to the whatever Polish or Greek commander. But I mean, he's obviously the only white guy in the race, so wouldn't that part of town vote for him anyways, you know?
Maybe he's just like, oh, you know, we gotta get with those people in the certain parts of town, like, you know, saddle up to the people of power in that parts of town so we could like give, you know, uncomfortable information to the masses throughout the city. So
he's a power.
I understand what you're saying then, like.
Yeah, he's a power broker in that area, old Valchek, so you got to make nice regardless if people will be white people. Not all white people, as we're going to learn with old Herc over there, are going to vote for him. Royce is in the mix, getting a different look. Getting all fresh.
Yeah, that clean shaven look is for sure just going to like bump him up in the polls. Like I mean, the show makes like all kinds of like relevant, like intelligent points about like what politics represents or like how it works. But it also shows like how kind of like stupid people can be that like they think like, oh, just like him shaving his face is going to like change up the whole dynamic of the race. And it's going to like put him out front that like even his aide Coleman Parker is like, oh, look at you. You look like you did in your fighting days or whatever.
98, which is 98. Is he referencing a mayoral election? Do mayoral elections happen in like that year? I don't even know.
Yeah.
But I mean, because O'Malley won in 99 to like get sworn in, I'm assuming in 2000. Like there's a lot of odd years where people win, like Schmoke in like 87. So I'm like, what the hell happened in 98? Maybe it's like he's getting bitches. And I was like, I
don't know. But to think that that's like a, you know, super effective campaign strategy is just like, what? Yeah. Like, what planet are you on? Like,
oh, not, you know, who's gonna let him know about that. We'll talk about Odell a little bit.
Sounds like a good thing you're doing there.
Whatever, man. Okay, yeah, so Coleman finds out that it's leaked because it comes on in all the television news channels. Yeah. TV, they watch the story. And everyone is...
Here's a cookie. Good job. You got that out.
Royce is pretty screwed because they gave it to Gray and Gray is running with it because, you know, Norm is very, very...
He's a devious motherfucker once he gets going.
Sounds like a good thing you're doing there. You're a good guy. Whatever. You know, pretty tactical.
Right, yeah.
On Norm's behalf, saying, you know, you're not going to win, but the better you look, the better will, you know, help. Like, it will help you down the line with your whatever, state legislator.
Run for Congress or something like that, yeah.
So, you know, hey, man, we don't mind Tony Gray on this podcast, right?
I would. Like, he's the best. He's definitely the best candidate. Like, by far, looking back on this, like, he said... Back in season 3, we got to focus on the schools and how right he was.
Yeah, so, I mean, what are your thoughts on what's happening? You know, it's like everyone's trying to save face with as far as Royce and his camp is concerned.
Right, and then we got Odell Watkins, or well, you know, he is trying to act like he didn't know what Commissioner Burrell was doing this whole time. He's like, I asked you to be shady, but not that shady. Yeah. Like, I just needed you to do some, like, kind of, like, crazy shit with, you know, hiding some reports or stuff like that. Like, learn how to, like, do your typical politician, like, you know, election season politician backdoor dealings. Like, don't fucking make me look bad. What is the matter with you?
Yeah, is Burrell not as bad a guy as we might think? Well, I don't.
Well, like, no, he is. I mean, he is, like, everybody's wrong in this situation or this argument.
But how incompetent he proves himself to be in the situation at doing something shady. Does that kind of hold, like, does that prove maybe what Rawls was saying? Like, you know, Burrell's a good man. Like, he's the, like, commissioner. He's got to know how to do dirt. Like, how else do you advance?
I mean, you got to take everything that Rawl says with a grain of salt, too, because he's devious and, you know, runs with the whole angle of, like, how they never took Ed Norris off the Braddock case in the first place and lies to the media and makes it known to the public that he's just as devious as Norm can be.
Oh, yeah. But let's talk about Watkins and Royce.
Please.
Oh, okay. Well, you made a note here. You're saying that you want to, like...
Right, because I didn't grasp the totality of the situation that was making him so pissed off in the first place, and that there are two different campaign flyers that they're running in different precincts where Unetta Perkins was endorsed in one, but Marla Daniels was endorsed in another. I didn't pick up on that, like, earlier in the season. I thought he just was, like, mad that Unetta Perkins was on the campaign flyer. I wasn't aware that there were two different campaign flyers for, like, different parts of the city. So I just want to put that out there.
Thanks for catching that. I would have never noticed that. Uh-uh. So Royce, though, still is full of crap, though, right?
I mean, he has to.
Yeah, like, he's not like, oh, it's just some mix-up. Like, you know how it is. And
yeah.
So
all campaign is all about dollars. You're in bed with every damn developer. You're even on Clay Davis's tit.
Oh, yep. Yeah, man. That's great. That's like a really, like, that's a great reenactment.
But it also, like, it makes me wonder, like, what is Odell Watkins's, like, story or his, like, background with, like, being an ally of Clarence Royce, because it seems like Clarence Royce has, like, always been, like, kind of doing shady shit like this. Like, in the very first episode of the last season, he's, like, you know, on his whole gentrification game and whatnot. Like, does Odell not, like, is he having a crisis of conscience himself in this moment, or, like, was he just naive about, like, Royce's political leanings all along and not realizing he was, like, you know, having shady poker games and and doing all kinds of, like, weird stuff? I don't know. Your take on this.
I'd say that's a pretty sound, you know, analysis, because, yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, it all is, like, one big machine, you know? Yeah. So I think, he might just be tired of playing the game at this juncture, because so he's a delegate, which is kind of like at the state level, the other. So he's basically like the, like, one part of the, like, he's the House of Representatives, but in the microcosm of Maryland. Is that what the state delegate is? And then you got, like, state senators like Clay Davis.
I think so. I think that's because accurate.
Then there are actual people who are, like, elected to the House from Maryland. But this is just, like, the micro level of politics. So I don't know. I mean, yeah, I'm sure that it's all, you know, he's a really powerful guy, but he's probably just had to kind of get along in some ways with Royce, or maybe Royce's changed. I don't know. I mean, do you think at one time Royce really was embracing this, like, facade of the, you know, like, Afrocentric mayor that he's trying to pull off now, like what he's saying, you know, you try to shave up and then, you know, whatever.
Marcus Garvey posters or whatever.
Which, you know, it's like,
it probably is just like a long time coming of Odell Watkins, like getting fed up with constantly having to compromise his own moral positions on a lot of these things. And he's kind of just fed up with the lack of progress that Royce is enacting, right?
So where is he going to align himself after this falling out with the progressive candidate?
Quote unquote. Yeah.
So,
but it's like, it's also like, you know, the show is like excellently paced and, you know, obviously very well researched and accurate, but this is like, so Odell goes out of like Royce's office and then immediately like one of the Secret Service agents is like supposedly like a double agent or something and immediately informs Rawls of it. Like, this wasn't necessarily like tracking that good for me. Like I felt confused by like, what does he have? Like, is he just like angling for more power or something? And he has a direct line to Rawls. Like,
yeah. I mean, cause that's Hoskins, right? That's the guy who Herc was reporting to get on that mayoral security detail or whatever. So yeah, I don't know what the hell, I don't know what's going on. I mean, all I found is that Hoskins and Demper, who's mentioned as like running for something, they may have their names, like their names may have been inspired by baseball players from Maryland. No, no. <It's> like,
yeah, nice.
You wanted some insight. I'm like, where are all these names? Like, why do they keep mentioning Hoskins? Wire is a weird show. It's like, yeah, let's spend this amount of time like developing this character's, like peppering in his name and blah, 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 just so he can like be on camera for one take, like a phone call to Rawls. Yeah. I don't. And then I'm loving the geo angles that you're getting into here, Willie. I mean, you're like, how does Rawls know exactly where?
Right.
I mean, he and Norm are.
Yeah. I mean, and like, it's like, he didn't even like give them a call on their cell phone. Like, hey, where are you at? Like, I'm going to come like give you some intel. He just like shows up as they're like campaigning door to door in some vacant row houses. Like, it's not specific just to this show. It's like a common like pet peeve of mine throughout all movies and TV shows where people just seem to like kind of like randomly run into each other, like for the convenience of the plot that they have like some information to relay to one another. So I don't know, just like a, you know, David Simon, Ed Burns, Richard, you know, like you guys created like the best TV show ever. These are just like minor little, you know, just like little things that I've noticed from watching the show a million times.
Little. I like that because, man, we really are like, we're agreeing on this heart. Like, this is probably, we agree on a lot of stuff, I think. Yeah. This is not like a combative.
Right.
Podcast, in my opinion, but
yeah, we're forming an alliance here.
Yeah, exactly. So Rawls works downtown, right, or at CID.
okay,
so he would have had to find Norm and Carchetti all the way up pretty much in, well, it is technically east side, but it's like Greenmount,
right
below the cemetery on Hoffman and Hillman in some little like side alley street.
Right. Is he just like driving around like thinking like, oh yeah, maybe Carchetti's out campaigning right now, and I just like went, maybe he's like stopped by the campaign office. I don't know.
I mean, I hate to always like, yeah, it's just, you know, the whole geo thing. It's like, oh, you know, I'm really into this, but then guess who else is really into geography? And like, it comes up, you know, and like little inside jokes about, where are you at, like, do you know where you are right now? You know, the police, they're really into geo. But I mean, man, Rawls, he might give Dookie a run for his money for like geo genius of the episode, you know, just based on finding those two out in the field, because it was hard to find. So I had to like really, you know, but I dual monitored that. But yeah, man, it's like in the, like there's, it's not even a main street. There's like a little side street. So the frustration is It's there for me too.
And then also like Norm's plan of like, wait till he turns the corner. Like, yeah, they're still then, like in plain view of Rawls's line of vision.
I mean, cause Rawls would have cared so much in that moment. Like he was probably angry that he wasn't provided that reaction, you know, like, what, I'm going to give you this nugget and just show up out of the blue and you're not going to like pleasure me by like scurrying, like running off like some fiends, you know, like trying to go find like a lion for testers, you know?
Right. And proclaiming to your driver to fuck them red lights.
I know what, like, sir, like they're supposed to be in public service and these two are out here, you know, it's like dangerous.
So then Carchetti makes his pitch to Odell, and we're kind of like left on like a little bit of a cliffhanger as to whether or not Odell will fully, like he says, it's one thing to sit out the primary, it's another thing to completely jump ship. So
yeah, man,
he wants Stokes in the 10th.
Stokes in the 10th, which is ironic because he was one of the main players in that big election that this is all kind of, you know, tied into. Carl Stokes was the councilman who ran against Lawrence Bell and O'Malley. Mm. So, but I don't think he was in the 10th.
Mm.
It's like the city council districts are confusing. They're always like shifting and
it's part of the simulation.
Jakob, we've noticed a really substantial amount of archive searches from your work computer. delete. Anyways, no one cares.
Should we move on to...
Encrypted.
Should we move on to the MCU?
The Marymount Crimes Unit?
Yeah. We're not discussing Black Widow. We're talking about the real MCU, not the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Oh, okay.
The Major Crimes Unit.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
I mean...
Give us some background on...
The actor who, like, for some... Like, I went on, like, not a deep dive on this guy, but I was just like, oh, God, like... You have one of those like character actor faces. I feel like I've seen you in a million things, but I can't quite place it. I guess he had like a recurring role in the last season of Boardwalk Empire, which I like kind of sort of remember. But this is Boris McGiver, McGiver. I think it's McGiver, right? McGiver. Anyway, but he apparently, according to IMDb trivia, he owns and lives in an old 1831 Baptist church where he was born and raised by his mother along with 9 siblings. He grew up working on farms and has said nothing has ever seemed like work since. And, you know, it's only natural that, like, nothing would ever seem like work since working on the farm because he's not good at working as his job as a lieutenant because he's, you know, caught up in the bullshit of thinking that just doing like these little buy bus street rips or whatever you want to call them is going to get Marlo Stanfield in a room with dope on the table. And, you know, it's a great little moment of character development that shows Cedric Daniels and Rhonda Perlman, like basically laughing off his approach or his plan to, you know, bust this thing wide open, because this is essentially kind of like the position that Lieutenant Daniels was advocating in the first season when they're trying to like bring down the Barksdale Empire. But he knows by this point that Freeman would be really upset if he knew that Mary Mao was cannibalizing the wiretap for this crap. So yeah. Great, you know. Great advantage of watching a TV show that has like many hours in it that allows these characters to grow, because Lieutenant Daniels is on the other side of the fence now and sees a bit of himself in Lieutenant Marymount and realizes he's making a fatal mistake for his career. But Marymount is much more like dickish about it. Like Lieutenant Daniels, you could tell he was just always trying to do the right thing and climb the career ladder, but like, you know, help everybody out in a sense while he was doing it. Mary Mal is just totally arrogant and stupid.
Yep, indeed.
So stupid that when they go on their little operation, that they end up on the 13, they end up on the 1200 block thinking it's the 1300. And like, little did they know that if they had Jakob, the geo genius, with them, he could have gotten them like on the right track and not scared an old man walking home carrying his groceries into raising his hands in terror.
I get it, but this is what I'm talking about, the fine line between like, oh, am I a cop now because I keep researching all these geo coordinates? But yeah, they're pretty stupid. They're not geo geniuses.
Yeah, they're definitely not.
They are not in the running for geo genius of the episode, which is something I'm going to be paying more attention to, Willie. So let's talk about, you know, two guys who, you know, if I want to give credit to cops and like their geo capabilities, you know, Lester and Bunk are scouring the city for the bodies, as Willie would say.
They're conversing with medical examiner, they're checking the sewers, they're going to Leakin Park, but little do they know, all they have to do is have like a brief little conversation with Duquan to know exactly where the bodies are and who's doing them in great detail.
Yeah, but Leakin Park's a crazy place. Do you think when we go there, we'll drum up the courage to drive through it? Like, after all we've seen, Willie. I mean, we've seen Dan Bell has some good footage going to Leakin Park with his buddy, and they are looking for EVPs. Remember his like that old random dude maybe not, I don't want to disrespect if anyone ever hears this, but he has like a colleague who is really intense and they're out in the woods and then he's like randomly talking about EVPs. So in an episode where Dan Bell's in Leakin Park looking for like bodies, it's really creepy.
They're looking for Marlo and his crew doing target practice with a bunch of glass bottles and aluminum cans.
That's definitely a quote from the book Homicide that Lester spits, right? About, you know, I was here on a cadaver search in cadet school and the commander said, you know, don't grab everybody you find. We'll be here all day. We're just looking for one specific one. So it's pretty dark. So, I mean, it's Leakin Park, which is everyone who knows anything about Baltimore, which is, of course, our listeners. You know more than just like...
Come on. Yeah. This is common knowledge.
Yeah. I mean, and also this is Leakin Park, which is where Heyman Lee was murdered from serial.
Right. Didn't even put that together at the time that I had listened to that podcast. It's been a really long time, and I feel like it would hold a lot more relevance for me now going on this little expedition that we've been doing the last year.
That will avoid Leakin Park.
Right.
Because it's creepy. But we're going to go there someday.
Damn. That was scary. I thought that sounded like an alarm. Yeah. Like someone would have just had like a really...
Hopefully that no one's pulling some capers next door at the goddamn construction site. But for real, pull a caper on those slumlords. But the alarm will go off and annoy me. But I'll still say, screw those slumlords, jerks.
Give everybody a little insight into your problems at home here.
I got some problems.
We want to talk about how Carver is kind of schooling Herc on like what he should be doing to advance his career, and that he should be like out waving a campaign sign for Mayor Royce instead of like, well, Carver basically acknowledges like, okay, yeah, we're going to have to do this bullshit with Marymount Street Ribs, but like what you should be doing is like thinking two steps ahead of this and like actually like... making campaign calls in Royce's office and saying like semi-racist stuff.
Oh yeah. I mean, well, That's what I wanted to really ask you about is, should Herc be that confident that...
No, just Herc should not be confident at all.
Okay. Should Herc be so certain? Okay, he shouldn't be certain about anything. Unfortunately, he is. But, you know, he just assumes that the lady he's calling, you know, like, can hear that he's white and he knows that she's black. But
eesh,
with the way that he speaks, you know, in that van with Sidner, you know, I mean, people might, like, the way people perceive his voice could be different based on, you know, his ability to speak in such a manner. So,
but that was a very poor imitation, yeah, or like, it's like appropriation. It's like
minstrel level.
Like, yeah, he's like dropping N-words. And
Sidner gave him the pass, or he's just so exhausted.
Yeah,
he wants him to leave.
I don't think Sidner's like... Sidner, I feel like, is way smarter than Herc and is not happy with him at this point because he can't get relief. He's been in the van all day.
He's always stuck in that van. Jesus.
I know, right?
So, yeah, but it is, you know, bringing up an important topic of race in the election that's, you know, taking place. And, you know, Carcetti reminds Odell and anyone who will listen that he's white. He's a white man.
Yeah.
And, you know, Herc's kind of someone that is, you know, operating outside of, you know, well, okay. It's about alliances this episode, right?
Like,
whether that be, you know, interracial or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, he's so outside of the realm of reality. Like,
yeah,
when he makes that phone call, he's like, I'm white, you're black, but I'm voting for the black guy. Like, he hangs up and he has like this look of like satisfaction on his face. Like, oh yeah, I'm doing something good here. Like, I'm really like making a difference in my community. And then, like, you know, the whole scene where Mary Mao realizes that, you know, Marlo's crew is way smarter than him. And like, they're two steps ahead of him. And, he enlists Herc to do something about like getting intel on Marlo's crew. So he like puts a camera in the concrete, like in one of the holes in like the concrete park behind Fulton, so they could like potentially entrap Marlo or catch him on camera saying something shady if they get someone to read lips. And like, Herc is like, oh yeah, this is fucking it. Like, I'm gonna be a hero because I'm the one who caught Marlo Stanfield. But of course they know like what's up, and he has one of his soldiers on the lookout and discovers that they're taking pictures, making movies of him. By the way, some cold-blooded shit Chris pulled there with Old Face Andre and like killing that delivery worker at the corner store. Pretty, you know, brutal but brilliant stuff. But
okay, brilliant. Much needed. Brilliant violent.
Do we think that like Herc in some way is like kind of responsible for like finally giving Marlo the little push to join the co-op because he plants the camera there, which like heightens Marlo's paranoia about it and makes him want to reconsider Proposition Joe's offer? Maybe we can like transition, or we start talking about the MCU, we can talk about Marlo's storyline.
The Marlo crime unit.
Ooh, nice. Yeah.
No, that's a fair point.
Yeah.
Herc's always involved in Marlo's like business and is really influential, right? Because down the line, he's the one who hands over the number, basically.
Yeah.
Crazy. They're, you know, that he's taken down by such a dick-headed dumbass, basically. But, yeah, I mean, I guess, yeah, I can't really see any other reason why, because this kind of, this initiates Marlo's interaction with Prop Joe, right?
Right.
Because he knows, like, he's seeking advice and also wants to seek out, you know, his own truths or determine whether Prop Joe set him up.
And like, they're meeting in a church? Like, is it like, does Proposition Joe like have the...
That's Boris McGibber's like house, actually.
He's like,
I tracked it.
Yeah, I'll let you use my house for a location. For, but for some, like, okay, like, I don't know exactly like why they're like, why wouldn't they just meet in like the hotel conference room or like why, like, strange circumstances, but like kind of like drives the point home of like the irony of like, you know, criminals being so like, quote unquote, involved in like religious piety, but they're like turning their backs to, you know, commit homicides and deal lethal amounts of drugs. For some reason, like, I really love this scene between the two of them. Like, I feel like they're both at the top of their game in terms of acting, and like always sends like kind of chills down my spine, I guess, like the way it's like paced and everything, with Marlo like finally reluctantly agreeing to like be a part of the co-op and therefore, you know, getting some protection, that like people have like incentive now to like look after what he's doing because, you know, he's part of the bigger power structure now.
Yeah. So Marlo says, you know, we gotta deal with the bushwhacker initially.
Mm-hmm.
And then Donnelly's whacking bushes. What's the you know, significance of that? Sorry, it's completely off topic.
Yeah, and they find Michael's box cutter in the bush or something, or somebody's box cutter.
Naaman claims he had a blade.
Oh, yeah.
Which we know that wasn't his. He's just trying to act up. Sorry, man, but...
No, it's all good.
Yeah, you know, Marlo wants maybe some security. I mean, at that point, does he want security, or is he thinking of an opportunity to just take over?
I mean,
it's like, I will own the co-op.
Right, yeah. Down the line, we realize like Marlo is way more demented than any other criminal in the Enterprise.
Yeah. So what about this indictment that Prop Joe's got here? This is kind of crazy.
And this is a callback.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't realize until you just said it, but this is a callback to earlier on in the episode that Rhonda Perlman says, like, oh, we're Charlie Berman. Yeah.
So she just says the Berman indictment.
Right.
And then like, oh, this is just whatever. This is what we're working with, but I'm tired. And then Prop Joe just says Charlie, you know, and they want to like clean up before the election or whatever to make it look like they are, you know, making a dent in the crime and go after the kingpin. So, yeah, I'm like, wait, that's not Charlie Sollers that Prop Joe's talking about, the mysterious person that, like, no, you know.
Buy for a dollar, sell for two.
Yeah, there you go. So this is, you know, crazy David Simon is utilizing, like, each part of a person's name in different scenes within the same episode.
Yeah.
But it's about the same person. How insane is that?
Pretty crazy. But it's also like how... Proposition Joe says he knows of these indictments and he's like, oh, I keep my ear to the ground, but I'm like, okay, really, but how do you know about this? Like, do you have like a weird special relationship with Rhonda Perlman where she gives you intel?
Well, has he done this yet in the show up to this point? Because we know that Avon has been able to get DMV records because so-and-so, you know, or as you like to say, imitate Slim Charles.
Yeah. Funny. Trina with the fat ass.
Funny. You're funny and evil. Oh man, I'm getting heat stroke. But yeah, it's just, you know, everyone kind of, you can't be a skilled, you know, dealer or someone of Prop Joe's magnitude, a player of that, you know, like mythic proportion, and not have an inside person, you know, on his payroll working at the court or something. But anyways, let's get into who this person actually is.
Yeah.
Simon writes about him in Easy Money in his little, like, there's a little blurb where he talks about all the big time players getting taken down, like broad-faced Charlie Berman. I'm like, what is up with face and like Baltimore kingpins?
Yeah, because there's old face Andre.
There's like, yeah, this guy and big head brother Lee, like a lot of, also known as Sebastian Gorka. No.
Burn.
But yeah, Charlie Berman. So just another supposed alleged drug player from the, seems like the time period where David Simon, you know, gathered a lot of his inspiration, like the 70s and 80s, which apparently was like a real wild time. So yeah, he just, I think he eventually got sentenced to a pretty long, like, or several decades of prison time for drug conspiracy charges. But again, he's like, it seems like these kind of figures that we talk about on the show are people who have inspired these characters or references. It's always more than just like heroin dealing and stuff like that. You know, right. It's like everything kind of interweaves, just like the plot of this story.
Right. And like in the articles he sent me, it was like more or less alleged that he was involved in like police corruption.
Yeah. Too. With Colonel Watkins. And you know, we got our guy Odell Watkins at the center of a lot in this episode, but you know, obviously different sides of
Colonel Watkins is who took over for Colonel Forrester because the chemo wasn't working.
Yeah, but yeah, so like that guy Watkins, Colonel James Watkins, was kind of a trailblazer as like a black police officer and ascended the ranks. But he also grew up in Baltimore and he's referenced all over, like in stories with Little Melvin. And apparently he and Charlie Berman grew up together, like in those articles they talk about. And then he was allegedly paying off Colonel Watkins to, you know, stay away from his heroin dealing. And then I guess that kind of investigation into Colonel Watkins about police corruption or alleged corruption was, I guess the catalyst for that was the Elijah Davis murder. Norris Davis's cousin, who's always at the center of everything, even if he's not. No. But but apparently that was like, you know, in the article I sent you, they, people said, oh no, he's just lying about that to, you know, get his sons off, because they were also arrested and charged on drug charges. So, you know, people say that Charlie Berman was just, he lied on the build. No. So it's pretty confusing, but yeah.
I mean, I don't know, like, why you would, like, kind of joke around about, like, Norris Davis not really being involved, since, like, The Wire is, like, kind of his life story. Yeah.
I'm sorry. No. I don't want to disrespect. I mean, Rim Source, check it out. but, yeah, man, I mean, crazy stuff with Charlie Berman.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's kind of like a blink and you'll miss it thing with Proposition Joe, like,
yeah,
presenting the documents showing the grand jury indictment or whatever. But you know, if you're Jakob, while you're blinking, he's pausing and Googling.
Hey man, no. I mean, yeah, I'm Googling if plugging in names into like a online archive database is Googling.
Nine.
Don't sell me short, man.
No, come I'm on. Sorry.
This is a at the Gods Will Not Save You, your support provides tools for us to do specific searches.
There you go.
but it's fun. But anyway, it's fun. Yeah. But I mean, oh yeah. But thanks for the compliment. And you know, that's why you tune in to this show, man, because we give you some crazy takes on like things that, I mean, that's why we're the podcast. Where else are you going to get like takes on reflections of, you know, camera operators and takes on Charlie Berman? So apparently he's like kind of on Norris's level though, where, you know, Norris Davis would throw parties. You know, we're not talking about fake Norris Ed. We're talking about real Norris
right.
Davis. He would throw the big parties for drug dealers about to go to jail. Well, Charlie Berman was having those parties in jail, kind of like in that article. I couldn't find, there's a more detailed one about what he was doing in jail, whereas that like little editorial, that little snarky op-ed where the guy didn't even like interview him, Olesker, maybe he's like, maybe he did. I don't want to, you know, start a beef with the son, you know, if he's still like active.
He was trying to do more with less.
Yeah, exactly. Ed Burns will be proud. But apparently when Charlie Berman went to the city jail where he was being held, while the trial was taking place in the late 70s, like 78 or whatever, or maybe this was after he got sentenced. Regardless, he had his own little, as they say, fiefdom or fiefdom,
right,
in prison, where he apparently was getting, you know, the people said privileges for like reporting on Colonel Watkins, but he became the head of some review board of like inmate complaints against officers. So he wielded all this power, and then he also got involved in the commissary and would like deprive certain inmates of like their stuff. And he would like, he would loan money to guards like on fat interest rates.
God, damn.
So Charlie Berman, man, if you're still out there and you hear us talking about you, you know, just know it's all good.
Come on the podcast.
Yeah, yeah, we'll get you. We'll get Linwood. It'll be a big party. And then he also was homie, or like he was affiliated with Lil Willie, who, like in such amateur hour fashion, back in previous episodes when Stringer and Marlar are like, you know, going through Stringer's little history lesson, like Little Willie, man. And I was like, oh, was that like Little Melvin Williams? Little Williams? Little Willie? But no, big time Democratic machine, like numbers guy. Yeah. Just crazy, man. I mean, he would give you a run for your money. Damn. Like as far as like Killy Willie type stuff.
Damn.
Nah, but apparently he was on a boat ride that Charlie Berman hosted in the harbor. Little Willie was there, and Little Willie's wife was like a council member as well. So I'm like, is he some weird, crazy, broken simulation of like what Daniels would be like as a political boss with a like wife who's in politics? I don't know.
Are we sure that when Claudel Withers was talking about the puzzle palace, he wasn't just talking about like where we are right now as we're trying to like parse out these details of like different names and how it relates to everything?
Yeah. But apparently Little Willie was like heavily invested in Mondawmin Mall. So thanks for giving like Naymond and all the boys of summer a place to go like re-up their back to school fits, Willie.
Well, I mean, that Mondawmin was just like the front for they wanted to go like steal, like kidnap some pigeons.
Oh, come on, man.
Yeah.
Return pigeons to Marlo's coop, Willie. Kidnapping pigeons.
Yeah.
Anyways, man.
So we already talked a little bit about like Chris and Marlo's like brutal plan of like framing Omar and getting Old Face Andre involved in it with like, you know, Chris killing the delivery worker lady and then convincing Old Face Andre to say that it was Omar before like pistol whipping him. But do we see this as kind of like a parallel with earlier on in the episode where Tommy gets this like new information as his assistant is the one to like really come up with a devious plan? Like Marlo's like, oh well, so you want me to just fucking let it slide with Omar? But then like Chris comes up with this whole like brilliant, like devious, you know, just as Norm is a devious motherfucker, Chris is also showing himself to be a devious motherfucker and strengthening his alliance.
That's a great take. I never thought of it that way, but that's why we're having this conversation. I mean, to discuss these things.
Who knows? They're like every episode, there's like so many different parallels between like people on the opposite sides of the law. We already saw this with like Naaman talking about Linkin Park and then Punk and Lester talking about how brutal Linkin Park is.
Crazy, man.
But anyway. Are we good with all that? Do we want to like finish things out with Bubbles' storyline?
Oh, yeah, man. Let's talk about your man Bubbles is really having a tough time. Like, not only has he been shorted wages and it's owed quite a bit by the Baltimore Police Department, specifically Kima and Kim Nulty. He's also now getting a brutal beating that is it's tough to watch.
It's tough to watch. he runs into Sherrod, dealing drugs on the corner when he should be in school, and like his math skills obviously haven't improved yet because he's having like a little disagreement or argument with his customer about how much money is owed. And the other guy is like, well, I need $4. take it out of your shoe, Bubbles. I'm going to beat the shit out of you. And by the way, all these little kids surrounding you are just going to laugh at you and shame you and ask somebody to bring out a shovel because you need to be buried.
Damn, that's like some, yeah, that's like a old school burn right there.
Yeah, that was pretty brilliant.
It's like an and one shirt.
But it's, you know, what's worse, Bubbles getting beat up or getting laughed at and told he needs to get buried by a bunch of kids? It's like, fuck, man. Like,
well,
keep driving it home throughout this show that, like, getting humiliated by a bunch of kids is, like, a fate worse than death. No, I'm just kidding. But it is,
There's Willie's take on these things, and there's pretty much the rest of human beings. Like, yeah, I'd say getting stomped out by a crackhead is 10, like, it's exponentially worse than getting insulted, but you would be like, that hurts so much more. It's like you're pouring salt and lime juice into my open wounds. Bubbles is already like on the, like his organs are already failing him, and he's now getting like stomped and kicked in the liver and stuff.
It's just like reinforcing like how painful the generational divide can be sometimes. I don't know.
Willie, seriously, man, we could also do like a little Patreon episode where we just kind of discuss some of the issues you might have with local youth, or is it the pool that they're at that you're just telling me about you swim at on Saturdays?
Nah, I have a crazy story to tell you about that once we get off the air though, but
oh, I look forward to it. But so about this beatdown, so Sherrod is, you know, he's on the corner, he's selling a package for somebody, right? He's not just independent.
Right, he has to.
I mean, he's on the, well, they don't really say it. Is this West Side or East Side? Whose turf is he on? I mean, it's actually on Brentwood and Pittman Place, over by the same cemetery that Carchetti was at when Rawls found him, Greenmount West. But, you know, Sherrod could have said something. I mean, because he had some respect, if you can call it that, for Sherrod in that moment, because he could have just, you know, stolen the drugs. Like, he was trying to make it right on the corner and pay, you know, or, like, work out a deal, right?
Right.
Like, if he was that wild, he would have just ripped, like, he would have ripped off Sherrod, blah, blah, blah. So is Sherrod not maybe flexing or helping Bubbles out because he's just overwhelmed and scared in that moment? Or is it because he's embarrassed to even be associated with Bubbles, given the, given the, you know, reaction of the local terrible, terrifying youth, as you say? Yeah. I don't know. I mean, that is a grown man beating up Bubbles. So I'm leaning towards, like, Sherrod's just overwhelmed.
And, yeah,
like, he's frozen with fear, or just, you know, he's still a kid too, in a way, even if he's like 16.
Right.
But What do you think?
I think so. Yeah, I think he's probably just like, he probably has some fucking nascent PTSD of seeing somebody else get beat up, and instead of like rising to the occasion, he kind of just like hides into a shell. I don't know. I can't like really get into like his psychological state to really like analyze why he did what he did in this situation. Like, after this, you know, beatdown occurs and Sherrod comes back home, you know, to hang out with Bubbles, he drops like a couple of heroin vials like on the nightstand, and it's like, I don't know, there's like a lot to unpack in like this little moment or this like interaction where he's like, hey man, like, I'm sorry for like what happened to you. Here's like the thing that's, you know, getting you into this situation in the first place, but it's like a token of my appreciation or gratitude, or I'm like apologizing to you. And then Bubbles is like kind of trying to tell him at the same time, like, oh, this is not the life for you. Like, the corner is like a horrible place to be, but at the same time, like, I'm not gonna like reject your offer. So it's like, everybody's like kind of wrong in this situation. It's like the same thing with Bubbles kind of being like, do as I say, not as I do, but thank you for giving me the thing that I do. And it's like, I don't know, man. It's like really fractured, complicated, horrible father-son dynamic they got going on right there.
But where does Sherrod come from in the first place? And how does he know Bubbles? No. It's just, it is what it is, and it's a vicious cycle that they're trapped in. And, you know, I mean, I wish maybe Sherrod would have just kept those vials and told the crackhead who's beating on Bubble, someone he obviously cares about, hey, just whatever, pay me back another time.
Yeah.
Take these.
Yeah.
And just leave us alone.
Yeah, I'll make it. I'll make up the money I lost from this interaction by like working extra, by doing overtime at Bubbles' Depot.
Or just like making one sale. But I get it. He can't come up short to whoever he is answering to on the corner, which is, I guess, Bubbles' point. Like, it doesn't matter which way you go, you're screwed. But
right,
it's just, you know, this is a huge, huge moment because this constant, you know, this problem that is now going to just fester with this rogue fiend who's like an Omar shotgunless, like, crackhead stick-up kind of guy. It's like a terror. It's going to result in, you know, Sherrod's death pretty much because Bubbles tries to solve it in the only way that he feels he can, which is, you know, trying to burn him. So,
yeah. And on that lighthearted note, I think we're ready to. Anything else?
Let's hit it.
I think we're ready to sign off and say once again, thank you so much for listening to this whole episode. You know, we got pretty crazy. We both, as Jakob said, we might have heat stroke and, you know, we're getting kind of loopy and saying things that don't make sense. You know, we're in the puzzle palace now. So, you know, please help us put together all these, you know, matching pieces and make a cohesive picture by connecting with us on social media. We're at The Gods Will Not Save You on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
And we're also up on our Gmail, which is The Gods Will Not Save You at the aforementioned gmail.com.
All right. And also thank you to Mostart, who provided us with the excellent music for our intro and outro and a couple of the little bumper things we got going on. Check out his music at mostart.com.
Yeah, tremendous stuff from Mostart. Also wanted to say thank you to our guy, Andre Tesnes, who designed our amazing emblem. We're forever grateful.
Right. Great. All right. Thanks, everybody. Peace. We'll talk to you next time.